Welcome back to another episode of RMV.
Hey guys, I hope you're all doing great. And today we are here with Dr. Rebecca Keith, the founder of One World Montessori School. And I actually attended this school from primary all the way to sixth grade.
Yeah, and I'm really excited to talk to her. And yeah, so we have Rebecca here with us to talk about her life as a Montessorian and learn more about the Montessori philosophy and talk about the impact of the COVID on the school.
So we wanted to start off by asking about your experience as a guide. So how long have you been a guide?
Let's see, since 1973.
Wow, it's been a while.
It's been a while, yeah.
Yeah. So why are you called a guide rather than a teacher?
Okay, well, initially Montessori used the word directress, or that was how it was translated into English from the Italian. And the idea is when you think of a teacher, you think of somebody who has an agenda, you know, has something specific that they're planning on teaching and teaching to someone. Whereas the idea of a directress or a guide is there really just to help each individual to direct their energy towards that which is most important to them, that which they're interested in. So it's more the idea of a coach or a helper that's there to help maneuver through an environment so that you can use the environment to the best of your ability, as opposed to somebody who already has a set agenda for what's going to happen. So we're much more there to help each individual child to move in the direction that they need to at that particular moment.
Oh, okay.
does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. It does.
Yeah. So I had another question. So you've been at One World for 40 plus year. So what are some of the different roles you've played, and which one was your favorite?
Oh my goodness. Well, I during the time that I've been there, I was always a guide within the classroom, as well as the founder and the head of school. So I think it's always been both exciting and challenging to have to wear a lot of hats, and in that sense, it can be overwhelming at times. But because there's always so much going on, it's also fun. Because you always have something new and different to go on. But my favorite thing is to be with the kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I started the school just because I wanted to have a school that would be specifically totally focused on what was best for the children. And finding it difficult to find an environment that I could move into that would do that, you know, I kind of ended up being in charge of it, but that was not my goal. My goal was to have an environment that would be totally focused, centered on the kids. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So what made you choose the profession? Why did you want to become a guide?
Oh, well, That's a good question. I didn't know anything about Montessori, and frankly, I never wanted to be a teacher. I always thought that, you know, those who could did, and those who couldn't taught. So that was not what I thought of as an adolescent, as and a young adult. That was not my goal to be a teacher, but after my son was born, I realized that there really was something more that he was going to need than just to be with me. I had thought, well, my dad is a child psychiatrist. My mom was a teacher. So I thought, well, I can probably handle this being a mom thing. And I remember he must have been about 20 months old, and he was sitting on my lap, and I was reading to him, and, you know, I can't remember what the book was about, but I was reading to him, and you know, talking about the pictures of the things on the pages and whatnot. And he said, no, 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 no. And he pointed down at the number in the corner of the book and said, what's that? And I thought, oh dear. So this is going to be a math engineering person. And this is something I'm not sure that I'm really going to be ready for all on my own. So I went and started investigating what was available in preschools at the time. So this was back in 1972. And the only thing that I found that would look like it was going to do anything at all for him was a Montessori school. And he started going to school, and the people in the school started saying, oh, gee, you're just a natural at this. You really ought to get involved. And so I thought, well, I'll go investigate. And through looking at different training centers, I found Ursula Thrush, who became my mentor and actually the first person that, you know, the first school that where I was a head teacher was her school, Maria Montessori School of the Golden Gate. Anyway, so I found Ursula, and I never looked back. It just became something that the philosophy just resonated with me. And it took over my life. So that's what I've done ever since.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite thing about working with kids?
Well, I guess that first of all, when you in a Montessori environment, you're there to serve the inner child. Mm-hmm. That's your purpose, and in order to do that, you have to be able to center yourself and then remove yourself in a sense from the equation, so that that individual or that particular individual has the opportunity to blossom forth. And when you're in that state, that state of service and awareness, and you're in the moment, and that's such a wonderful place to be. And so, it's a gift in a sense. You give a gift to the child by putting yourself in that state, and the child gives you a gift by giving you a reason to be there. And so it's a wonderful symbiotic relationship that, so at the end of the day, I mean, you're tired at the end of the day, but you feel really as if you've fulfilled a function, served a purpose that was towards the greater good. And so that's a wonderful state to be in. So that's what I miss most now with, you know, being mm-hmm. separated from everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it must have been really, like, it must have been incredible, like, your journey so far as, like, a teacher. So my next question is, so being a teacher, like, it has its own struggles and hardships. And because of the pandemic, you know, a lot of jobs have changed. And, like, it's, teachers are, like, it's kind of hard, you know, from doing it at home, like, teaching kids through Zoom and stuff. So my question was, what are some challenges you have faced, and how do you manage special needs for children?
Well, again, I'm not in the classroom anymore, so I haven't actually had to deal with that personally. I speak with my teachers on a daily basis, and during the initial lockdown, when everybody was doing distance learning, it was incredibly challenging. These are very young children, and they need to learn by doing. They need to move. They need to be able to interact in a three-dimensional way with their environment. That's part of how they learn. The hand is really connected with the brain, and action is sort of really important part of interacting with the environment. So it was incredibly challenging. And I think that, no matter how well the teachers compensated for mm-hmm. the situation, they were not able to bring, you know, the full richness of the Montessori environment. So the whole being in a virtual educational situation was very difficult for everyone. Some of the kids, you know, couldn't focus sufficiently to be able to, you know, interact for any length of time on the computer. You know, the screen is the opposite of what we want for the kids. I mean, part of what our guidelines for parents is to keep the kids away from screens and to allow them to really interact with the natural world and with the environment in a physical way. So it was, I think, especially challenging for Montessori. Mm-hmm. And even now back in the classroom, wearing masks, for instance, I mean, during, when you talk about the 3 to 6 year old, for instance, mm-hmm. which is the age of the children that we work with in the primary, they're still in the process of acquiring language. And one of the major things they need to do is watch your mouth. But when everybody's wearing a mask, they can't see. Mm-hmm. So, especially kids that have some deficits, as you were discussing special needs kids who have language issues are especially challenged because they don't have the opportunity to see the movement of the lips. Mm-hmm. So that they're just a lot of challenges. And Montessori, with the idea of freely interacting and spontaneous activity within education, to do that when you have to remember to socially distance and always wash your hands and wear your mask, all of those things interfere. So it makes it especially challenging. Nonetheless, the children are so glad to be back in the environment with one another, and the teachers are really glad to be there. You know, despite the challenges of you know, sanitizing things and keeping people distant and not being able to have as many kids in the class and all of those COVID restriction issues come up.
Yeah, it's very stressful.
You guys are probably experiencing that in your education situation as well. So everybody is coping as best as they can.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, my mom. Yeah, I know how stressed my mom was, especially during the beginning of the quarantine, how she had to do online school. And like, it's still very stressful for her because of all the restrictions and stuff. So, and it's really amazing how the teachers are working together and how the kids, you know, have to follow these, you know, tough guidelines, because, you know, they're young children, you know, so it's really hard on them too.
Yeah, no, I think this is going to be something, you know, that we've all lived through an historical time that will, you know, that will be remembered for centuries.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is, you know, a huge challenge for the whole world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So another challenge is that, you know, guides can face is parents. You know, sometimes parents can be more challenging than kids, so you must be an expert with dealing with them. So what are some tricks?
Well, I think the most important thing is to remember that we may be the first adult outside of the family configuration to interact in a meaningful way with this child. Mm-hmm. And the child is the most important thing in the world to a parent. I mean, you know, this is their baby, right? So to remember and honor that relationship, and make it really clear that your goals are the same, that we all want the very best for this child. And what you're trying to do is to share your experience and expertise so that we can do that in as successful a manner as possible. And one of the things especially with young children is consistency is so important. They get really confused if things change too frequently and if people approach them from too many different angles. So that, you know, our goal is to work consistently to help the child develop in an optimal manner, and, you know, so that we're working on this together. And I think that helps with whatever communications that you have to have, and you know, just to remember that everyone has the child's best interest at heart. We may approach it in different ways because we have different experience, but if we can all focus on our end goal, then we can be successful.
Okay. I was going to go to the next topic, so you can.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I was going to say, so you talked about being a guide. So what is the most memorable moment about being a guide?
Oh my. I don't know if I could think that there's any one moment that would be most memorable, but I guess I have a story that I can tell that kind of illustrates what's a little bit different between being a teacher in an environment and being a guide in a Montessori situation. This was years and years ago. I had a very challenging child in my class, and he was disturbed for a variety of reasons. But one of the things that he manifested because of what was going on with him emotionally is he would sometimes hurt our animals. Mm-hmm. You know, because in a Montessori class, we try to have an example of each kind of vertebrate in the environment. And and part of what the children do is they learn how to care for the animals, what they need in their environment, and that kind of thing. And so it was important that the children were able to interact with the animals. But when we'll call this little boy Matthew, when Matthew would get angry or upset, he would sometimes mistreat the animals. Mm-hmm. And we found ourselves in a really difficult situation. And so what I did is I brought the issue to the class as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, we were sitting in circles and we discussed what was going on, you know, and that Matthew was having problems and he was upset, and what was, because he couldn't control himself when he was upset, that he was hurting the animals. And, you know, we had brought the animals into the environment, so it was our responsibility to make sure that they were well cared for. And if they couldn't be well cared for, then I'd have to remove the animals from the environment, because it wasn't okay. But I didn't want to take the animals away from the environment, because I wanted everybody to have the opportunity to interact with them. And I didn't know what to do. And you know, did they have any suggestions? And one of the kids said, well, maybe what we need to do is we need to have like an electric eye. This was a long time ago, but you know, that was where it would let you know like how it makes the doors open and close when you come near them, and that would signal that something was going on with Matthew, and it could help us make sure that nothing happened. And then another one said, well, we probably couldn't do that, but we could all be like the electric eye. We could all keep our eyes on Matthew. And if we saw that something was, you know, he was coming near the animals and was going to do something to harm them, that, you know, we could let him know that that was not okay and help him stop to do that. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, how wise of these children. You know, they didn't, no one said, oh, well, we should kick Matthew out of the class, or, you know, get rid of the, I mean, you know, they looked at the situation and figured out a way. And so they all agreed that they would be the electric eyes in the room and make sure that, you know, they reminded Matthew, and Matthew, you know, agreed that, you know, this would help him, because he didn't want to hurt the animals. It was, you know, he just would get upset and forget. And not
properly. It's amazing.
Incredible. But I think, you know, just the innate wisdom of the children is what I am constantly amazed by and thrilled by.
Mm-hmm. So moving on to, we want to talk more about Montessori. So Montessori was founded by Maria Montessori. So can you talk more about her and who she was for those who don't know?
Sure. Okay. Maria Montessori was, from the best of our knowledge, the first woman in Italy to become a physician. She was born in the late 1800s, and was always, you know, a groundbreaking kind of individual. Just in her own life, she wanted to pursue a mathematics, and of course at that time girls weren't taught mathematics, and so she had to go to the boys' school, and she had to convince her dad to let her go to the boys' school, and becoming a physician was a huge challenge at that time, because they wouldn't, you know, part of what learning about anatomy involved working on cadavers, and they wouldn't let a woman look at a naked body in the same space at the same time that men did. So she had to do all of her anatomy work alone in the morgue. So, I mean, there were just a huge number of challenges to do that. But once she became a physician, what she was fascinated with was the process of learning and how mm-hmm. children learned. And this was the turn of the century, really. And at this time, any child that didn't function normally was called a defective. And often these children were all put together in like orphanages, institutions where they were cared for. And she was there with the head of one of these institutions, and they were observing the children during lunch. And she saw that the children were taking their bread and rolling it into balls. And the head of the orphanage said, basically, see, these children are so defective, they don't even understand that this is food that they need to eat. And Montessori said, no, these children are so deprived of stimulus that even though they have food in front of them, they're using that to make something to interact with. Mm-hmm. So she had a very, very different perspective on what was going on in the brains of children from many of the other leaders of her time. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so she developed a whole set, in fact, the sensorial materials that you had in your classroom. Those materials were developed specifically to work with children that were defective, that had special mm-hmm. needs. And they focus each one on just one sense at a time to help make the sensory input less confusing, and mm-hmm. so that a child that had issues might more easily remediate the problems that were going on. But anyway, so after creating these materials and working with the defective children for a while, those children began to normalize and even surpass what was going on with normal children. And this was just considered an amazement, and you know, educators and people from around the world came to mm-hmm. see what was going on in this mm-hmm. environment. And then I believe it was 1918, I don't remember the exact date, but this was the time of when the Industrial Revolution was happening in Italy. And so peasants from the countryside were coming into the cities to work in the factories, and the factory owners had created, you know, basically housing developments where the people could live. But the mom and dad were away working in the factory, and there was nobody to watch the kids, and the kids were breaking things and getting into trouble. And so they decided they needed to hire somebody to watch the kids.
Yeah.
And this was for Montessori, this was her opportunity to have a chance to see what's going on. Because I mean, you know, these kids were, you know, just basically running wild. And it wasn't, you know, like, you know, nowadays, could you possibly experiment with a group of children? I don't think so. But in her situation, she basically had free reign. And so she took over the job as the head of the school to mm-hmm. handle these children, the daycare center, whatever they would have called it in Italy at that time. Mm-hmm. And began to experiment with what to put in the environment and you know, how to interact with the children and how to create a optimal learning environment. Mm-hmm. And that's how it began. I mean, in the beginning, all of the equipment, as you know, the in a Montessori school, all of the apparatus is displayed on shelves that are open to the children, so they're free to choose. Well, that didn't start out that way. All of the materials that she thought would be interesting or educational for the kids were all in a locked cabinet, and the teacher would come and open the cabinet and things would be brought out. And one day the cabinet got left open for some reason, and she saw how the kids were able, by being able to choose, that was a better situation for them. And that's how that whole idea occurred. So it was very much a very scientific, experimental approach to figuring out what would be the optimal situation for learning for children within that specific stage of development. She also probably was the first person who really looked at childhood from a developmental perspective. She was probably the first constructive mm-hmm. developmentalist. And she, in her theory, looked at the child as going through four different phases of development, or planes of development is what she called them. They each one of 6 years in length. So birth to six, six to 12, 12 to 18, and 18 to 24. She didn't feel that people had completed their childhood development until they were 24, which we now are finding is pretty much true. The brain isn't quite done until about that time. So anyway, she through trial and error and experience, she developed an entire methodology of education mm-hmm. that we now duplicate today.
Oh, it's an interesting backstory of her. Yeah. I didn't know that either. So even though I went to the school, so it was very cool.
We don't do a whole lot of, between 3 and 6, you're not too interested in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was very cool to know.
Founder of the methodology, but
Yeah,
it was fascinating to know about Maria Montessori, because I didn't know about it. I've researched about her, and I was telling Mega too. I think she's an Italian physician. So it's really insightful, because I didn't really know anything about Maria Montessori. So moving on, so the next question was that I had was, what is the difference between the Montessori and the public school system, and why do you prefer the Montessori than other schools?
Okay, well, I guess again we were talking in the Montessori environment, it's a child-centered environment. So it's focused on each individual child discovering what their interest is and pursuing their interest, and then the adult acts as the servant to the inner child, to the development of the inner child. In a typical public school environment, it's adult-centered. The adult has the agenda, the adult has the idea of what they're going to teach, the adult stands in the front of the room. Everybody's in their place, and everybody looks at the adult. And the stimulus comes specifically from the adult. So they're totally different one from the other. Mm-hmm. The adult has planned exactly what's going to go on, what the lesson plan is for the day, and they follow that lesson plan. And everybody learns everything at the same time. Mm-hmm. In Montessori is spontaneous activity in education. So the children spontaneously are stimulated by the environment, which is prepared by the adult. And the environment is a very rich environment. When you think of a public school environment, you think of, basically desks mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. whatever is the stimulus is going to come from that adult. In the Montessori environment, it's a room full of multiple shelving units with all kinds of challenging and interesting and intriguing pieces of apparatus that all each piece of apparatus embodies a concept, and through interacting with that piece of apparatus, the child will inculcate that concept.
Yeah.
So in one situation, the energy and the input is coming from one adult in the center of the classroom and in the Montessori environment. All the different variety of equipment provides stimulus, and then each child individually interacts with whatever it is that piques their interest at that moment in time. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different picture. When you walk into a typical classroom in a public school, it's going to be quiet except for the sound of the adult speaking, unless they're having a discussion. In a Montessori room, it's much more like a little office where everybody's doing their own work, and there's kind of a underlining hum of activity, but you know, it's not particularly loud necessarily, but it, you know, there's just a real energy of activity going.
For sure. Yeah, I remember, you know, graduating from Montessori in sixth grade and then going to public school. It was like totally different. Public school was very structured. You have your own seat, you have your own work, you have one class after another. You couldn't like, you know, choose what to do. Like I remember in sixth grade, I get to choose what subject I want to do today, what work I want to do today. So it's very, very different. Yeah. So we want to talk more about One World Montessori. So One World Montessori has three locations in San Jose. Two of them are primary schools and the other one is first to sixth grade. Is there a history behind the name One World Montessori? I always wondered why you chose the name One World.
Well, when we first started the school, this was started by a group of parents and myself and the woman. Her name was Beth Nerney, who had been my assistant. And we were all sitting around we wanted to come up with a name that would reflect the, because Montessori's education for peace. Right. Because that for me especially, that is the center, the focus, the nexus of that everything comes from. It's the idea that, because I mean, Montessori really felt that if human beings could fulfill their function and not be blocked in their development, that we would be a more peaceful species. Mm-hmm. And that was part of why she spent her life working with children, is because she felt that if we were to have peace, we would have to start with the children, and basically grown-ups were a lost cause. And so that idea that, you know, nationalism tends to separate us, and so the idea of one world, and I can't remember whether anybody actually initially came up with that, or if it was something that was just part of the group focus, and but that was how we came up with One World. Is we wanted a name that would symbolize that idea of unity within diversity, mm-hmm. and focusing on the idea that we could work towards a more peaceful, mm-hmm. for all of us to live.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. you want to go ahead?
Yeah. So the next question was, why did you decide to start a Montessori school rather than work at one? And what inspired you to start this Montessori school?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question in itself. I was very distressed with the manner in which the school where I was working was being run. The focus of the owner of the school, and it was several schools that were owned by an individual. They were for-profit schools. And the focus was on the profit as opposed to on the children. Mm-hmm. And we as employees were not treated well either. We didn't have any health insurance. There were not sufficient materials in the environment. So I finally could not continue to work for this individual anymore. And so the parents said, but we want you to be our kid's teacher. And I said, well, I don't know anything about running a school. I was 30 at the time. And they said, well, you know, we'll help you. And so we formed a nonprofit corporation and off we went. I mean, you know, the first year that One World existed, Beth and I, and we had another assistant named Matt, the three of us in the classroom with, it was just one class of 3 to 6 year olds. So the three of us in the classroom with 36 or something kids. And when the phone would ring, the phone was in the closet. I would go, and I'd run into the closet to answer the phone because we didn't even have anybody in the office. And my mother-in-law did the books. So it was very organic. It just started because we all wanted to stay together as a group, but we couldn't stay together under the auspices of the person that I was working with. Mm-hmm. And so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this school has many cultural events such as United Nations Day, International Peace Day, and Earth Day. I remember United Nations Day was my favorite cultural event. I loved visiting like all the different types of countries, seeing their culture, trying the different foods, dressing up. So do you want to explain what United Nations Day is for those who don't know, and like what's the importance of it?
Sure. Again, Montessori felt that it was through exposure and knowledge that we would be able to better get along with one another. You know, that if you see something that you've never been exposed to before, you might feel frightened, alienated. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of feelings could create gaps and separations between people that you know might be responded to in violent or threatening ways. Mm-hmm. And so she felt that exposure at an early age to as much diversity as possible was really important. And so it seemed to me that the whole idea of the United Nations was the idea, you know, sort of fit in with the idea of one world, right? And so I came up with this idea that we would get together and we would, you know, everybody that's in the United States, aside from the people that were native to this country, came from someplace else. And so that if we could, each one of us represent the country and the customs and the costumes and the food of the place where our ancestors came from, it would show us how from all these diverse places, we can come together and enjoy and understand and accept all of these differences and have a good time too. And so it started out just as a very kind of small thing in the beginning, but I developed the script, the words that we say and everything. And so it becomes a celebration of, well, in a sense, specifically where we are here in the mm-hmm. United States, where we come from so many different places. But anyway, what our celebration is for, I think it takes us about 2 weeks to practice. Each child picks a country that they're going to represent, a country from which one of their ancestors mm-hmm. has come. And their parents help them get a costume. And they learn, we all learn a song from that country. And then we practice learning all the songs. And we talk about within the script, each child has a part to play. They speak about, you know, how we all live on one world, what the world is made mm-hmm. of, starting very concretely at that point, and that yet we come from all of these different places. And so then we go, we have two large hemispheres that we place outside on the blacktop, and artifacts from each of the countries are placed on these hemispheres. And then we basically travel to each of those countries. The children that represent the country will come and place a flag on the country on the map, and we sing the song. And after we've visited all these different countries, then we all have come together in this country that we call home, the United States of America. Then we have songs that we sing from that, and then we end with Gandhi's peace prayer. Mm-hmm. And the idea of us all being able to come together and work together in peace. So that's a kind of the in a nutshell, that's the United yeah. Nations Day celebration. But it because the kids are little, it involves the music and each one having something special to say, the sensorial experience of all the different beautiful costumes. And then at the end, mm-hmm. we go into another area and all have a wonderful smorgasbord of food from all over the world. So they have that also that sensorial experience, and the parents are involved as well. And mm-hmm. so it brings our whole One World family together in a way that says we honor and enjoy all of our differences, and we work together to make a more peaceful mm-hmm. world.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, you guys celebrate so many other ones, as I said before, like International Peace Day, Earth Day. And like these events are not really, you know, celebrated in public schools as much. So what's like the impact and learning experience do you think this celebration provides to the children?
Well, I think one of the things that is difficult in a diverse community is that we don't have a lot of rites and rituals that we celebrate together. People have a lot of different celebrations that they may do at home, but we don't acknowledge those. And mm-hmm. I always felt that rather than not acknowledging things, we should be acknowledging everybody's special things, and that we needed to create rites and rituals that we could celebrate together that in a sense bind the year. And give us focus. You start out with International Peace Day, then we have United Nations Day, then usually we have a winter celebration, and then the end of the year is Earth Day and graduation. So these are rituals that we perform every year that give rhythm to a kind of a cyclical time, because again, Montessori is a 3-year cycle that the kids go through in each classroom. And so these give rituals that give meaning, but the ones that we specifically focus on are ones that give importance, you know, an acknowledgement to things like peace, diversity, caring for the earth, those kinds of things. And because the kids that are there the kids that are there, like Indy, who go all the way through sixth grade, they've been through this cycle 9 years. Mm-hmm. And during this formative period of their life. So these are things that I think we can say we're quite sure, we hoped in the beginning, but that we are quite sure that these are things that are meaningful for all of our children and remain with them. I think that because of the drama and the color and all the sensorial aspects of them, they stay with the children. I mean, when I talk to kids who are 40, you know, they say, oh, I still remember United Nations Day. and yeah. you know what that how wonderful that was, what a great experience that was. And I think, you know, by having it be that big of a deal, it mm-hmm. shows that the importance that we give those ideas. So even yeah. at a very young age, those things become important, just as, you know, in your own families, there are mm-hmm. certain rites and rituals that you perform. And because people give them that import, mm-hmm. they are important to you.
Yeah.
And meaningful. And, you know, this was our way of giving import to these kind of big ideas in a way yeah. that it would be meaningful for a young child and would mm-hmm. stay with them as something that would be impactful on their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. I love always celebrating these events. I think they're very cool, very fascinating. Yeah. I think it's very important to celebrate these events too, because, you know, not a lot of people know what these are, and it's important to educate, you know, the different types of cultures and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to add on by saying, like, I think it's important that schools celebrate these events, because as you said, Mrs. Rebecca, that, you know, it's like a way to come together and stay united. And yeah. So mm-hmm. the next question was, how have you noticed children and the school system change through the decades?
Well, what I think there are several things that have impacted children. Probably the largest issue is that kids don't have any downtime anymore. And I think that makes it really hard for them to find their center. I think you really need the opportunity to get bored before you can figure out how to really stimulate yourself, right? In a positive way. And I don't think kids have a chance to do that anymore. When I first started teaching, a majority of the kids had stay-at-home moms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now everybody works. There's no time for family, and then there are all the special activities like dance and music and, you know, all those things that parents feel the need to offer to their children. And so, you know, kids just don't have downtime anymore. And yeah. I think that's a very sad,
right.
sad situation for all of us. And also just that parents are so busy, and I'm sure that the whole COVID thing, you know, just is, yeah. impacts this yeah. even more with everybody trying to do so much, wear so many different hats. I think that oftentimes parents are just so stressed mm-hmm, that it's hard for them to make good choices for their families. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the largest negative impact that I've seen over. Also just the prevalence of screens, you know, with mm-hmm. TVs, computers, telephones, but, you know, I mean, you know, the interaction between human beings is really being impacted.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
We also see a lot more special needs kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I don't know if it's, I think that all of these environmental impacts that we have, the nobody staying at home, specifically paying attention to the kids, the work, the pressures from work, the distractions of all these devices that we have, all are environmental stressors that increase the prevalence of these potential things. I don't think people are more disturbed now than they were, but it's just all of these factors make those potential problems manifest. Whereas, you know, if kids had plenty of time with parents who were relaxed and taking them out into nature and going on hikes and doing all those kinds of behaviors would ameliorate that situation. Whereas, you know, the sitting down in front of the TV or the computer while people rush to get something on the table to eat dinner before you have to go to bed, you know, it just doesn't do the same thing for the soul. So I would say that those are the kinds of things that I see that have changed mm-hmm. since I first started teaching back in the 70s.
Oh, that's interesting. It's very interesting. So I think this is it. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's always nice to see my former students too.
I really miss, you know, going to One World. My sister's at One World. She's going to graduate this year.
Come back and volunteer.
Exactly. I always volunteer at my mom's school, and it's always so fun, you know, working with the kids. And unfortunately, I couldn't volunteer this year because of the COVID. But once it's all over, I want to go back and help the kids. It was very fun for me.
As always, thank you. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. And yeah, thank you so much, Mrs. Rebecca, for coming. I mean, this is like a really good episode to record, and I learned a lot about the Montessori school. And because like I haven't really interviewed anyone this big, you know, that's like works in the Montessori school and the founder and stuff like that. So this was really fun for me to record, and I got to learn more about it. And we hope you guys had a great time. And if you haven't already, make sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. And we appreciate the love. Subscribe to our YouTube channel if you want more video type content. Special guests will be aired on YouTube, and other collabs will be on other broadcasting platforms. Visit our website, megaversion.com, and email us at megaversion2020@gmail.com if you have any questions. Yeah, so thank you so much again.
Thank you so much for joining.
Okay. Goodbye, girls.
Have a great day, everyone. It's me, Varsha.
And Mega.
Signing off.